Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on dead men's secrets when we come back. You know, in Job 38, verse 24, we read a scientific question. It says, by what way is it that the light is parted? Or paraphrased, it says, by what way or technique is the light apportioned or separated? Can you imagine asking that question 4,000 years ago? It is, of course, today a simple one, and the student instantly answers, well, by passing it through the prism of the spectroscope. But who could have known that 4,000 years ago in Job's day? And since it's manifestly impossible for any human mind to frame a question that the mind knows nothing of, a greater mind than the mind of Job is the questioner here. But when we heat a metal red hot or heat any substance until it's incandescent, it gives forth rays of light. These rays, after passing through the prism of the spectroscope, divide themselves on the graph according to the content of the matter that sent them forth. So when a ray of light reaches us from some far-flung star, it need only to pass that ray of light through the spectroscope to see the composition of that star and the proportion of each of its ingredients. This division of light rays is always constant. It doesn't vary in the least particular, so that we may always rely upon its results. It's called spectroscopic analysis. And spectroscopic analysis is an exact science. And this is the manner by which the light is apportioned. Now, this places us in a quandary, because either Job knew this, or we're dealing with a supernatural wisdom here. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the scripture. And it's one more of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School. For more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. It's the place to start. It doesn't cost anything. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book called Dead Men's Secrets. So last time I gave you an introduction and I said, hey, listen, there's some big monuments around the world. In fact, in this chapter 16, there are 57 of these examples of architectural marvels and wonders that are built around the world that we can't build today. You know, it's one thing to say, well, yeah, we could duplicate that today. But when you've got monuments out here, as I pointed out last time, you've got a block of rock that weighs 200,000, not 200 tons, 200,000 tons, which is five Queen Marys. Somebody quarried that block of rock and then moved it and set it in place. There isn't anybody in the world today that can do that. The entire Russian apparatus, the American, the Russians, the French, the British, the Europeans, the Chinese, all combined, can't pick it up and move it. Now, somebody did that past tense. Now, how'd they do that? We don't know. We ain't got a clue. And there's 57 of those stories here in the book. It's called Dead Men's Secrets. You can probably get a copy of it at Barnes & Noble. It's fairly new. It's 2004. The author's name is Jonathan Gray. And it's put out by an outfit called, kind of an odd publisher here. I've never heard this name before. They call themselves Teach Services Incorporated. Published by Teach Services Incorporated. They got a webpage. It's www.teachservices.com. And it's a T-E-A-C-H-S is in capitals, and ervices.com is in lowercase. It's the way they've got it here in the book. I'm very impressed by the book. I have heard about these stories. I have heard about batteries in the Museum of Baghdad. And I've heard of airplanes out of Ecuador, model airplanes, you know, little models of airplanes that were jets. You know, and today we would look at that and say, my God, that's a jet airplane. And made out of silver, you know, little ornaments and things like that. And you hear about these little stories, the 14-foot skeleton I told you about last time that was in the museum up in Chicago disappeared. And this author points out that the Smithsonian is sitting on warehouses full of this stuff. and they won't put it out. They haven't destroyed it. In some cases, they have. It's been destroyed, but much of it is in the warehouses, and they're not putting it out on display. It doesn't fit evolution, and if it doesn't fit evolution, then we don't put it out. And so this guy wrote a book. See how many pages are in here? It's a pretty thick book. It's 300 pages. Come on, page numbers. Show me your stuff here. Oh, my God. Tell me there's no page numbers. Here we are, 350. Yeah, it's 350 pages or more. 350 pages, and it talks about geography, astronomy, cosmology, mathematics, metallurgy, large-scale construction, construction techniques, social organization, engineering, mechanical devices, everyday items, clothing, art, medicine, flight, space travel, ancient science and civilization, all of it documented, all of it with physical evidence that we have uncovered over the last 200, 300, 400 years. And it's sitting around in warehouses, being carefully hidden, being carefully concealed, but it's all well documented. And he's done a very professional job, footnoted it, showed you the sources. I got to tell you this story. Now, last program, I told you about a 12,000-foot elevation here in the Andes Mountains, where they've got these this fantastic city over here with the ruins and so on, well documented by the Spanish when they got in there. They blew it up and destroyed most of it. Some of it, I mean, the site's still there. Most of the rocks are still there. They got pictures in the book here of the rocks. The tragedy of it was the destruction that was wrought by the Spanish. They just came in there and just tore it all to hell. Not exactly clear why they tore it all up. They didn't all have gold and silver in it, but much of it did, and they robbed it and stole from it. And did you know that there are pyramids in the world that are bigger than the Great Pyramid of Cheops? Now, if you're like me, you know, you heard that the Great Pyramid of Egypt is the biggest pyramid in the world. Down in Mexico City, 40 miles out of town, there's a couple of pyramids called the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Moon. I saw those as a kid. You know, I was about 20 years old or so. I went down there and I looked at those pyramids. I'm like, God, these two pyramids look just like the pyramids over in Egypt. How could these people over here in the New World be building pyramids that look just like the pyramids in Egypt unless they had had some kind of communication? Now, I can see people building a pyramid, you know, on both sides of the oceans, but you got to have, you know, if they look alike, they got to look different, you know, if they never had any communication. If they look exactly alike, well, then obviously one saw the other and copied it. I don't know who copied what from who, but I'm pointing out that these pyramids are all over the world. It isn't just here in the New World or in the Maya lands or the Aztecs and so on, but hell, these pyramids are in China. They're in Australia. They're in the United States of America. Did you know we got 9 pyramids over here in the United States of America sitting over in Illinois? I never read about those pyramids here in the United States when I went to school. I never heard a word about them. And one day my wife said, my wife is from Illinois, and she said, have you ever heard of the pyramids in Illinois? I looked at her like, pyramids? She says, yeah, they're about the same size as the Great Pyramid of Cheops in Egypt, and there's 9 of them in Illinois. And I looked at her like, lady, you got to be out of your mind. There's no pyramids in America. If there were, I would have heard about it when I went to school. And she said, well, turn left here. Let's go take a look at one. So we drove out into the countryside. And here's this great big mountain. There are parks. You know, the state of Illinois has a park there. I climbed to the top of one of them. The top of the pyramid, the top of this pyramid in Illinois, is 1/2 acre in size. That's the top. The top is 1/2 acre. It's bigger than your house. It's bigger than your lot for most of you people out there. I was looking on the computer last night, and we were taking a look at houses in the Los Angeles area, and there's lots, 7,000-foot lot, 8,000-foot lot, 6,000-foot lot. I mean, you people live on pieces of ground that aren't as big as the top of this pyramid. I'm not talking the bottom of the pyramid. I mean the top of it. And then yet sits on acres and acres of land, and it's 400 feet tall, and so it's built out of dirt, and somebody packed all that dirt up there. I'm telling you, boys and girls, that if you had to go out here and build that pyramid today, if you called the Caterpillar Tractor Company, you'd have to have a major contracting outfit like Guy F. Atkinson to come out there and build something like that. You know, we look at it and we say, oh, well, just a bunch of Indians with a bunch of baskets carrying dirt stacked it up there. There's no Indian tribes around here ever claimed that they built that thing. It was there when they arrived. That's what they're telling them. Well, anyway, here, listen to this. The tallest building in the world until this century, until the 21st century, and still the most massive structure on Earth is an ancient pyramid 120 stories high. 120 stories. All right, now, the Great Pyramid is 450 feet high. That's 450 times 10. It's 4,500 feet. Is that right? No. I think the Great Pyramid of Cheops, if I remember, is 450 feet divided by 10. Yeah. That's 45 stories. Now remember that the Twin Towers in New York, the Twin Towers, they're 110 stories tall. Remember that? I think they were 1,100 feet, as I recall, because there's 10 feet to a story, no round numbers. So you got 110 times 10. Yeah, they're 1,100 feet tall. All right. This pyramid is sitting in China today. today in China. You know, where they find all these great things every once in a while. Well, it stands on a long, desolate, flat stretch of land 40 miles west of the ancient capital, Xianfu, on an old dirt road caravan trail and crosses from Peking, or Beijing, they call it today, to the Mediterranean. About 2,000 feet at the base, it rises some 1,200 feet. All right, it's 2,000 feet at the base, and it rises 1,200 feet. 1,200 feet. The Great Pyramid in Egypt, 450 feet. This one rises 1,200 feet. There are actually seven pyramids, flat-topped, with three carved giants resting along the outer edges. The four faces of the pyramids are, like so many ancient structures, aligned to the compass points. Traces of color remain on the sides, indicating that colors that were given to each side, east, aqua green, south, red, west, black, north, white, and on the flat tops, traces of yellow. A pair of American adventurers who roamed Asia between the two world wars, R.C. Anderson and Frank Shearer, were shown these pyramids, and Anderson visited Egypt's pyramids in 1970 and believed himself to be the only man living to have seen both the Chinese and the Egyptian pyramids. In 1946, a U.S. Army airplane crew rediscovered and photographed these pyramids from the air. Place 26 skyscrapers the size of the Empire State Building, and you have the volume of the largest Shenzi Pyramid. All right, you ever hear of that? I hadn't either. So I wanted to tell you. Some skyscrapers' heights and constructions in China equivalent to 120 stories, Ecuador 60 stories, Egypt 48, Bermuda seabed 42, Italy 35, Iraq 30, Guatemala 23, India 22, Mexico 21, Kampuchea 20, Arabia 20, and Turkey 20. Now these are all buildings or monuments in China, Ecuador, Egypt, Bermuda, Italy, Iraq, Guatemala, India, Mexico, Kampuchea, wherever that is, I can't tell you. If you want to check me out, Kampuchea, probably some new country in Africa, Arabia, and Turkey, 20-story tall building. Hell, we weren't building 20-story buildings until 1900. And they're still here. These structures, by the way, boys and girls, have withstood time for thousands of years. And it's a thought that all of these structures are built before Noah's flood and survived the flood. Or they were built right after the flood in the period of time between Noah and the Tower of Babel and up to the time of Abraham, which would have been around 2000 BC. Now, some of these monuments went through the flood. I would guess they survived the flood. I could be wrong about that. They may have all been built on this side of the flood, every last one of them. But my guess is that some of these things, especially up in the Andes Mountains, unless, of course, they had that technology after the flood, and then it was destroyed after the flood, which this guy points out could well be the case. Now, this is the section on construction, large-scale construction. There's another section in here that's called construction techniques. It's chapter 17. There's 64 examples of construction techniques. He starts off by saying, it is a human impossibility, gasped Hyatt Verrill. And he's right, and yet it happened. The great mountains of the Peruvian Andes are awesome enough until you gaze up those extremely steep slopes and you perceive the death-defying ruins perched on top of these mountaintops. The setting is terrifyingly wild. Mountains miles high, vanishing into the sky, notched with narrow ledges, slashed with ravines and bottomless gorges. Waterfalls of an awesome beauty plunge from these immaculate snowy peaks down into the damp, unknown depths of the canyons. So rare is the air that even the mules are obliged to stop every 10 paces to catch their breath. Here at the frontiers of the impossible, a vanished civilization set gems in stone, astoundingly assembled polygonal walls suspended over the abyss. They carved practically vertical stairways up stupendous precipices. High in the clouds rises one acrobatic stairway of 64 steps, which had to be carved in a place where one could only get a toehold for support. Another comprises 600 steps. Just imagine that. And then here are the pictures of these stairways up these mountains. Now, these ingenious jewels, or jewelers in rock, ascended a dizzying mountain no wider than the blade of a sword and topped it with watchtowers and walls pierced with lookouts. The mountain drops away so abruptly that if a workman slipped, his body would not hit the bottom for 3,000 feet. Today, on all sides, the ruins of temples, fortresses, and towers surmount the peaks and cling to the vertical sides of the canyons like ivy. Overlooking a waterfall, a splendid palace rises above the fierce abyss, impossible to reach. How was this palace built? terraces were miraculously inlaid into vertical slopes, perched over the canyon faults. How did they hoist up heavy, carved rocks by the thousands? Site after site is built atop bluffs, which are too steep to be accessible. Many seem to have been literally hurled up as though the monstrous stones flew there. A high carved niche opens out over the abyss, under a ridge shaped like the letter I. The rock was leveled and encrusted with carefully joined stone cubes. Only a daring mountaineer hanging from a rope could possibly reach it. The builder magicians, I tell you, had no sense of the impossible. Everywhere loom buildings that defy the laws of equilibrium and gravity, as well as vertigo. These are a triumph of human daring and of technology which almost smacks of science fiction. And would you believe it? Sometimes the enormous blocks were brought from quarries more than 1,000 miles away. Now, boys and girls, let me point this out. You got rock. Now, these aren't the super big rocks. These are rocks, you know, of 10, you know, be 3, 6, 9, 10 tons. Little rocks, about the size of the rocks that went into the Great Pyramid, the blocks of rock. But they're raised up on mountains, steep mountains, that are up around 10 to 12,000 feet in the Andes Mountains, where the air is so thin that the mules have to stop about every 10 paces to catch their breath. Now, how the hell do you build stuff like that up there in those mountains? It isn't being built by muscle labor. It's being built by some kind of machines and mechanical labor. Now, many are covered with intricate carvings. No man alive could duplicate such carvings with the stone tools that we find. As Hyatt Verrill remarks, it is not a question of skill, patience, and time. It is a human impossibility. And we're just taking a look at it, boys and girls. It's there. Like it or lump it. There's the pictures of it here in the book. And I've seen this, you know, time and time again. It was the Incas and the Aztecs, you know, that built some of these monuments years ago. How'd they do that? Where'd they get that kind of technology? And the thing here that is so ingenious in this book are that these kinds of monuments have been found all over the world, and the genius that this guy, Jonathan Gray, has put together here is that he's rounded up not one or two odd ones like you and I have heard about reading about it in Reader's Digest or some odd story. I mean, he put it all together. Antarctica. There are traditions of a legendary rainbow city where the colors of the rainbow are said to have been used in the construction of the buildings and even in the paving of the streets. In Rome, glass-storied theater. Emilio Scauro, S-C-A-U-R-O, Scauro, one of Sulla's generals, had a three-floored theater built at Rome for 80,000 spectators. The first floor of marble, the second floor of glass, the third of gilded wood. Boys and girls, 80,000 spectators. The big stadiums of baseball and football today hold 50. You know, the big stadiums. Is there an 80,000-seat stadium here in the United States of America? If there is, send me an email and let me know where it's at. Would you? I don't think there are any 80,000-seat stadiums anywhere in the world today. I haven't heard of any. This guy in Rome built an 80,000-seat stadium. Worldwide, the use of concrete, the standard mixture of sand and cement that makes up most building blocks of today, was evidently worldwide. Listen to this. They found it at Yaxuna, Tacuba, Mexico, Cuasillo, Mexico, Guatemala, Quito, Ecuador, Kunsa, Ecuador, Marchusni, Peru, Santa Cruz, Bolivia, Pompeii, Italy, Tourette-sur-Loup, France, Cohard, France, Crete, Stavreko, Yugoslavia, Egypt, Northwest China, Western Australia, Arkansas in the USA, Tennessee in the USA, and New Mexico in the USA are all sites where we have found ancient monuments or buildings made with cement that we didn't discover and use here in the modern world until the last two centuries. Well, obviously the concrete technology was available all over the world, for crying out loud, thousands of years ago. Well, how come we didn't have concrete over the last 1,000 years if it was available to those people 2, 3, 4,000 years ago? Boys and girls, they had technology years ago. And then we lost sight of it. We went into what we call the Dark Ages. And then Julius Caesar went into Alexandria and destroyed 1 million volumes in the Alexandria Library. And the Romans, you know, have been called the great builders, you know, the great civilization. The Romans were the great destroyers. The Romans destroyed more than they ever built. Civilization and technology was so much greater than when the Romans were here, as to defy description. The Romans never discovered anything. They destroyed what they found. And that's one more example. Let's take a look at another one. The seabed off Bimini, but now raised into a jetty material at Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Perfectly drilled five-pointed star holes with sharply defined tips cut right through 12-foot-long blocks of granite. Other huge 1/2 to 6-inch diameter round holes perfectly drilled through 12-foot-thick blocks of rock. Granite, one of the most abrasive stones, wears expensive diamond drill bits down to nothing very quickly. Okay, kids. And they took it off the seabed, off Bimini. It's now sitting in the jetty material at Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Perfectly drilled, five-pointed star holes with sharply defined tips cut right through 12-foot-long blocks of granite. Another huge 1/2 to 6-inch diameter round holes perfectly drilled through 12-foot-thick blocks. Hey, kids, we ain't had that technology over the past 100 years. Where'd those people get it thousands of years ago? 200 years, 500 years, 1,000, 2,000 years ago. Where'd it come from? Did it come from savages evolving from monkeys, dragging their hands or knuckles on the ground? Come on, kids, let's grow up and get real. You know, the people over in Borneo who are still living back in the Stone Age are not doing that kind of technology. And you're sitting there saying, well, you know, we men, we're getting smarter and smarter as time goes along. Hell, we can't do that today. Over in Turkey, the boring of holes finer than the thinnest needle in a block of hard stone. Over in Turkey, they got holes bored through stone, which is finer than the thinnest needle. We can't do that today. Boring into granite rock with drills that turned 500 times faster than modern power drills today. 500 times faster. In Peru, Tibet, Egypt, and the Sudan, outer walls sheeted in gold, silver, polished marble, or sparkling white gypsum. Granite building blocks, smoothly polished like glass. Practically all buildings of antiquity have been stripped of their outer shiny surfaces, so that today we see only the raw stonework. In Syria, Babylon, Mexico, Samaria, plaster-coated surfaces. In Tibet and Babylon, decorated enamel or blue porcelain walls. Enamel, blue porcelain, Tibet and Babylon, today. China, Babylon, Mexico, and Egypt, multicolor surfaces on building exteriors. In Brazil, the use of different colored stones in the approach steps to buildings. Peru, steps polished like glass. Bolivia, colored decorated pillars. Greece and Peru, hydraulic gates opened by means of a complicated jet of water. In Crete, Etruscans, in Italy, hydraulic lifts. Essential to the support of highly technological society must have been the use of massive water storage dams of modern strength. The enigma was, vestiges of these appeared not to exist. As I sought for evidence, the question kept emerging. Had river rampages obliterated all traces? Recently, one solution to this mystery fell open in quite a bizarre manner. Arkansas. Carpet rock, an area an acre or so in size, which recently split off the Petit Jean mountainside, has a curved grid of ironwork running all through it that gives it the carpet appearance. Examination, however, shows it to be reinforced concrete with the steel gridwork still intact and little rusted, surprisingly, until you realize that it was sealed from oxidation until splitting off the cliff only recently. The whole cliff, carpet rock, and Petit Jean is thus seen to be one vast concrete pour. Very, very old. It was the spillway of a vast dam which must have contained the White River and the Arkansas River in one great impounded lake. Now, does this sound like the work of semi-primitive men who had to use stone tools, horses, and vine ropes? No, the early builders obviously had sophisticated techniques. In later times, methods became more basic and building less ambitious. The earlier apparatus fell into disuse, gradually disintegrated, and was ultimately lost to history. That's here in Arkansas. Carpet rock. Features of houses, 2- and 3-story dwellings. In Lebanon, Crete, Tunisia, Arizona, houses of 5 and 6 stories. Pakistan, Babylonia, expert construction in bricks. Expert construction in bricks, similar to our own, heated to about 900 degrees. So they weren't just making mud bricks, boys and girls, they were making fired bricks. And let me give you a reminder here, we're talking about dead men's secrets. But meanwhile, I got to remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing Dead Men's Secret by Jonathan Gray. You can get a copy by going to www.teachservices.com. That's spelled T-E-A-C-H-S-E-R-V-I-C-E-S.com. Now, it's all caps. T-E-A-C-H-S is all caps. And then E-R-V-I-C-E-S.com is lowercase. All right, we've been taking a look at construction techniques and large-scale construction. I'm an old-timey contractor. That caught my eye right away. I see these buildings, monuments. I see concrete being used, cement being used in ancient structures. I see pyramids in China. I see pyramids in Mexico. I see pyramids in Illinois. There are pyramids all over the world. Pyramids, like the pyramids of Egypt, all over the world. Who built them and why? I suspect many of those were built before the flood. And if not, then the technology from before the flood, assuming that it was all destroyed, then was built after the flood in that period of time between about 2350 BC and about maybe 1400-1500 BC, maybe a 1,000-year period. Now, there's a lot of questions that you probably have in your mind that are answered in other chapters in the book. Always keep in mind that when I review a book, I cannot read the whole thing to you. You know, I can't cover every page, every subject, every topic, every chapter. So I pick out of the book those chapters that are really boggle the mind. Now, there's one in here that deals with electricity. Have I got electric in here? Where is it? Geography, astronomy, cosmology, mathematics, metallurgy, large-scale construction, construction techniques, engineering, mechanical devices, everyday items. There's a chapter in here that deals with electricity, and I can't put my finger on it. So I'm not going to spend the time looking for it right now. How about microscopes? Microscope. Did Moses have a microscope? Now, we know that Galileo discovered the telescope, you know, sometime in the 1500s. And then from that, somebody got smart and they said, well, if we can see out to the moon, can we see something a little bit smaller? And then we polished glass, and then we made the glass convex and concave. And as time progressed, we finally came up with microscopes. Well, listen to this story. It's chapter 15, glasswork. Microscope on a sexy spider. Leaping lizards. What do you make of that? Shall we bank for another run? The Peruvian flyers could scarcely believe their eyes. Spread out below, all over the desolate Nazca Plateau, was a mass of geometric patterns and giant pictures of birds, animals, and people as far as the eye could see. These ground-drawn objects were so numerous that they could be seen only from an airplane. Small wonder that they were not discovered until that day in 1939. Now, here are some really fabled, and you've probably heard this, what do they call this thing now? Nazca, N-A-Z-C-A. Imagine if you put that into a Google search. You probably get a lot of information, Nazca. Anyway, for those of you that are uninitiated, down here in Peru, up around 15,000 feet, there's a flat plateau. And on this plateau is a spider. This spider is 6 miles across. It's built about 18 inches high out of just little rocks. Somebody went out here, and they just picked up little rocks, and they built a stone wall 18 inches high. and they build it in the outline of a spider. And the thing is 6 miles across. 6 miles. And it's in perfect size. I mean, the legs are the perfect size with the head, and the head's perfect size with the body. And it's got all 8 legs, and they all stick out in one thing. There's monkeys and other animals, and there's people, and they're 6-8 miles across. The only way you can see, when you're on the ground and you're walking along, what you see is a stone wall. And so you walk along and you say, gee, here's a little stone wall, 18 inches. It won't keep a sheep in, it won't keep a llama in, it won't keep a cow in, and it's about 18 inches high, and it's uniform in height, and it goes out there for a long, long ways. I mean, you can look down this wall, and it curves, you know, and it's, but you can't see what it is. You could not tell that was a spider by looking at this walking on the ground. But in 1939, some guy's flying over it with an airplane, taking pictures, and he says, oh my God, there's a great big spider down there, and it's 6 miles across. Well, then they went down there and they started measuring this thing. Who built that? And who built the monkey? And who built the people, you know, the outlines of these people in these 18-inch stone walls? That's who built it. And then the question is, why? Why would anybody do such a thing? Because you couldn't appreciate it. You couldn't even know it was there unless you were in an airplane flying over it. You have to be in an airplane. You got to be up in the air over the top of it to see what the hell it is. That's how big it is. Now, that tells you pretty plainly that whoever built that thing built that to be looked at, and the people that are going to look at it are going to look at it from an airplane or from up in the air. Could be a gas balloon, I mean, you know. But then if that's the case, then gas balloons were invented before 1700. First one I heard of was a hot air balloon flown in France about, you know, 1705 or something like that. But it gets better than that. Not only do we need an airplane to see this, fashioned by an unknown pre-Inca culture and covering an area of 30 square miles, they're still unexplained. So here's 30 square miles of plateau with a number of these monuments, these monkeys, spiders, and people laid out on the ground in 18-inch high little rock walls. We have no idea, working from the ground, anybody could execute such figures in perfect proportion. They can be observed successfully only from 1,000 feet in the air. One of the drawings depicts a spider. It has one leg deliberately lengthened and extended, and at the tip of the leg, there is a small cleared area. Now, there's only one spider known who uses the tip of its third leg in this precise manner shown in the drawing in this 6-mile-long rock wall spider. It's called the Ricinulli. It's spelled R-I-C-I-N-U-L-E-I. Ricinulli. That's the way I'm pronouncing it. It inhabits caves deep in the Amazon jungle. This spider is recognized by scientists for its unique method of copulation, for which it uses that extended leg in the described manner that's in this spider at Nazca Plateau in Peru. It is an extremely rare species of spider. Now, for the incredible part. This spider's mode of reproduction can be only observed by the aid of a microscope. Boys and girls, let's stop and think about this for a minute. Up here on top of this plateau is this huge spider, 6 miles across. You can't even see that this is a spider unless you're up in an airplane at least 1,000 feet in the air. So you can look down on it and see 6 miles across. This spider is in perfect proportion. It's built out of rock. It's not big rocks now, just little ordinary rocks. You can just pick them up and stack them in a rock wall. And the spider now, from the tip of one side of it to the tip of the other side, is 6 miles across. And then from the other side to the other side, it's about 4 miles across. It's wider than it is. It's longer than it is wide. So it's 4 by 6 miles. You've got to be in an airplane to see it. The third leg is extended in a way that only this rare spider extends its leg. This leg is used in copulation, in reproduction. And the only way that you can see the way this spider reproduces with this leg is with a microscope. What's that tell you? It tells you that the guy that built the spider up there had to have a microscope to observe the spider so that he would know that the spider reproduces with this third leg. Then when it's reproduced, it's done by a spider being built in stone walls in perfect proportions 4 by 6 miles. Now, boys and girls, that's quite a story. So the question is, how were these artists able to find and then observe their tiny model, unless we concede that they inherited a knowledge of science equaling our own, including the use of the ground optical lens in a microscope. Turning, therefore, to glasswork, we find ourselves treated to more surprises from the ancient world. And yet nothing is incredible any longer. The word impossible should have become literally impossible for us. China, before 2500 BC,
Assyria, 2700 BC, and Medzamer, Armenia, 2500 BC, the making of glass was well known. In Haifa, Israel, a glass block weighing 88 tons. There are only two masses of glass that are larger than this 88 tons, and both are the casts for the huge mirrors of the Mount Palomar telescopes. Got this? Ancient times, 88-ton piece of glass. It's sitting in Haifa, Israel. Now, we're told, of course, that ancient man was backward. I hope my curiosity will be pardoned. I have a question. How did those early races develop the enormous amount of heat necessary to melt the ingredients into this enormous mass of glass? Well, obviously, this block is inexplicable, except with reference to a super technology. Now, I want to point out that when you got a piece of glass 88 tons in size, boys and girls, those Mount Palomar telescopes, that telescope of that 200-incher up there, it's bigger. It weighs more than that 88 tons. Now go back, do a Google search on Mount Palomar. They built the thing back in the 1930s. And when you read the story of how that Palomar telescope was built, it'll just boggle your mind. And here is a story. Back in ancient times, they got a block of rock that they call glass. It's 88 tons in size. Huh? Boy, you got to have real technology. That Palomar telescope was designed and built by the Corning Glass Works in New York. They were the only people in the world that could cast a piece of glass that big, and that was back in the 1930s. Then the thing had to be shipped on railroad cars, special railroad cars, out to California. Then they had to move it from the railroad cars in Los Angeles up to the top of this mountain. I mean, it's a story that just boggles your mind. It was a hell of a feat back in the 1930s. And here we got the same thing going on thousands of years ago. But they didn't have railroads, and they didn't have trucks. They didn't have gas engines. They didn't have furnaces. Way back there, they were dragging their knuckles on the ground, hitting their old lady over the head and dragging her off by the hair. That's what we're told in school. Come on. What we're dealing with here in modern times is a fairy tale, like the Land of Oz for adults. Evolution is a fairy tale for adults, and they tell us long, long ago and far, far away. What a bunch of horse pucky. Now, the book again is called Dead Men's Secrets. The author is Jonathan Gray. I'm not sure you'll find this book in a used bookstore. It's pretty new. It's published in 2004. I think if you went to Barnes & Noble, they'd probably get you a copy of it. Dead Men's Secrets. I don't know where this came from. I've got books stacked up here in my office that are here for review. I probably have 30 stacked up here now. I picked this book up the other day. I couldn't set it down. I never saw anything like it. Now, I've heard these stories. I've heard of that Nazca Plateau. I probably read about it in Discover Magazine or maybe Reader's Digest, you know, or something like that. And then, you know, you read these odd stories, and then you say, God, that's really amazing. And then, you know, you don't hear any more about it. Over a course of a lifetime, you probably can think of 10 or 15 of those. This guy Gray has them in here by the hundreds. There's one section in here that has 103 examples. On construction, there's chapter 15 and 16. One of them is 57, and the other one is something else. I've forgotten exactly. Yeah, here it is. There's 57 examples of skyscraper height, huge constructions, and et cetera. And then there's 64 examples of construction techniques that are modern. You know, techniques like concrete that I told you about. Now, I can't sit here and read them all to you because I want to cover a broader spectrum than that. But listen, there's 18 areas of life and technology, like sailing around the world. You know, Columbus discovered America back in 1492, and they say, hey, he was the first guy to get over here. I've mentioned this in the past. That's poppycock. Poppycock. When Columbus got here, there were people here, for crying out loud. To say Columbus discovered America is nonsense. When he got here, the continent was people. There were people everywhere. So obviously those people got over here somehow. So the archaeologists come along and say, well, yeah, they did, see, but there was this land bridge between Siberia and Alaska. And they came across that land bridge. Well, that's probably true. There probably was a land bridge there at one time. And people probably came across it. But there were ships, and these people knew about ships, and there are examples of ships. Now, of course, now we got this fairy tale, Columbus discovered America. And a guy by the name of Barry Fell, I've reviewed his book here, it was called America BC, shows that there are Egyptian ships and Roman ships that are sunk off the coast of New England here in the United States. And coins from those ships wash up on the beach. Then they go out in the water with scuba gear and they find these ships sunk. And then they go down in the ship and they find coins. And these coins have dates. And these dates are 300 AD or 300 BC. Now, how long do coins last? Reach in your pocket and pull out some coins and look at the dates on the coins. Men have been making coins for thousands of years. And these coins have dates on them. What's the oldest date that you can remember in your pocket? Do you have any coins 100 years old? And the answer is no. Coins don't last for 100 years. They last for about 20, 30, 40, 50. So we put a date of 100 years on a coin. When you find a coin that's dated to 328 AD with an Emperor of Rome's picture on the face, then you know that it was within 100 years of that date. And when you find lots of coins with lots of different dates, you can just about date within 100 years as to when that ship sank. That's the bottom line. We got ships all over America. We've got coins from Phoenicia and Egypt and Syria and Babylon all over America that have been found and dug up here. Somebody says, well, you know, some guy brought it over here and then lost it. Oh, okay. And that happened hundreds and hundreds and thousands of times. And they're all lost. Now, if you believe that, you can believe in the Wizard of Oz. You can believe in long, long ago and far, far away. But that's not where reality is located, kids. All right, now let me give you the name again. It's Dead Men's Secrets, Jonathan Gray, www.teachservices.com. Probably get it at Barnes & Noble. If you can't, then go to this website. And it's Brave New Bookstore, bravenewbookstore.com. They're in Austin, Texas. And they'll get it for you. Tell them what you want, and then they'll go find it. This isn't an underground book. It's out here in the public domain, I imagine, from Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com or somebody like that. Go down to your local bookstore. You're looking for Dead Men's Secrets, Jonathan Gray. This is a 1-in-100 book. I've been around for pushing 70 years, and I've never seen another book like it. This is the only one. I've read these stories before, one here and one there. I never saw a guy that put hundreds of these stories together and compiled them all. And that's the value of this story. Hey, I'm out of time again, kids. We've got to leave it right there. So let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet daily. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to get yours. Just call us direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.